Welcome back to Insights Unlocked. Today, we dive into the rapidly evolving world of AI startups with tech visionary Chris Messina. Chris, known for inventing the hashtag, shares his insights on how AI will transform our daily lives and work. He and User Testing's Andy McMillan discuss productivity, job disruption, and Chris's investing strategy in AI startups. Enjoy the episode.
Welcome to Insights Unlocked, an original podcast from User Testing, where we bring you candid conversations and stories with the thinkers, doers, and builders behind some of the most successful digital products and experiences in the world, from concept to execution.
Welcome to Insights Unlocked podcast. I'm Nathan Isaacs, Senior Manager for Content Production at User Testing. And joining us today as host is User Testing's CEO, Andy McMillan. Welcome, Andy.
Hey, everyone.
And our guest today is Chris Messina. Chris is a product leader, investor, and, oh, by the way, the person who invented the hashtag's use on Twitter and now every social platform. Chris is also the co-founder of the recently launched Ride Home AI Fund, which is investing in AI startups. Welcome to the show, Chris.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Welcome to the show. I think this is going to be a really fun one. As Nathan mentioned, you're the co-founder of the Ride Home AI Fund, and I sort of want to start there. Obviously, it's a huge topic, but I think you have a really interesting sort of perspective, basically not from your experiences, but sort of where your investing thesis is. I want to read a quote from you from a recent interview related to the fund. You said, by this time next year, we will be shocked at the software that doesn't have some kind of generative AI aspect to it. And so if you take that for granted, then the question is, how do you imagine this spooling out over the next 5 to 7 years? So that's the end of the quote. So now the question I have is, how do you see AI's role in existing businesses, and maybe especially startups, really changing the course of the next 5 to 7 years? Like, what should we expect?
I mean, I was going to say, you know, if I knew the answer to that, I would be investing in the space, and here I am. You know, the other funny thing about that quote is that the Ride Home AI Fund is actually under a year old. So we launched that fund in March. So even though I said within a year, you know, and my timing, I think, is pretty good in that respect. It is a question, of course, that many of us now are grappling with much, I think, sooner than perhaps maybe a lot of folks thought. And, you know, I think for me, I bring a lot of experience working in like social platforms, developer platforms, APIs, the broader sort of like web ecosystem. And, you know, when I was getting started, you know, as you mentioned, the hashtag, like back in 2006 or seven, working on social products, there was a great deal of skepticism that people would be using these platforms on a regular basis. And now, of course, they've kind of woven into the fabric of society for better and worse. And I imagine that even though history doesn't necessarily repeat itself, it does rhyme. And in this case, we'll probably see similar types of things in the weaving of artificial intelligence and generative AI into common experiences, but in a way that's both, you know, subtle, profound, and will become a lot more commonplace faster than I think a lot of people think. I think the best way to, I don't want to say it's the best way to predict the future, but what I find useful, you know, as I enter into various stages of maturity, or immaturity, I guess, depending on your perspective, is to, you know, look at younger people who are growing up in a world where, you know, ChatGPT, who we call Chad in our household for short. You know, Chad is basically like a member of the family. It is a study companion. It is someone that helps to, like, you know, check thoughts or ideas. Whereas when we were growing up, you know, we would go to Google and, you know, kind of outsource a lot of trust into this list of 10 blue links. And we wouldn't really ask the question of like how they got there or why they were there. And only in the last several years, I think, have people started to ask the question about how those things get there and what's the whole incentive structure around that. So when it comes to AI being woven into our lives, if I look at, you know, the kids in my household who are using these generative AI products, it's like normal. It's like having running water in the household. So once you start there, then you start to think about work being done with generative AI as a companion. And it starts to make a lot of the things that we, I don't know, find annoying or irritating, or, you know, just getting like solving the blank slate or the kind of blank page problem, you know, in terms of like writer's block, becoming something you can get over very quickly. So the level of productivity is going to explode. the ways in which people can coordinate and collaborate, I think will also accelerate, because now you have sort of something that almost like you think about Google Translate, but for professional fields. You know, when I talk to people who are like, you know, developers or engineers, there's a lot of translation that needs to go on. And if there's this tireless, never gets patient, never is judgmental kind of, you know, AI coach that's like helping me to explain rudimentary concepts so I can participate in a conversation I would have otherwise been excluded from, that's going to expedite the level and depth of collaboration that's possible. So I know that those are like kind of like high level, but I think there's a lot to unpack there in terms of allowing us to move beyond the sort of concept where, yes, jobs will be disrupted. Yes, work is going to change. That's been true ever since the internet came around. And we're just sort of living through, I don't know, the second or third wave, you know, sort of like, you know, there's like the tsunami thing where like the wave or like kind of like pulls away from the beach right before like this enormous flood rushes in. And I feel like that's kind of what we've been living in for the last several years. And only now do we have the compute power to index and hold the entire internet and web kind of in RAM, and then to answer questions based on everything that's been stored and written up into that point. And isn't that amazing? And isn't that terrifying? And the answer is both yes.
Yeah, I think you're spot on. And I feel like for a while, we've been trying to do sort of quote unquote natural language stuff, yes, which is such a developer way to speak about things. And the reality is it was
like, never very natural.
Yeah, it's like instead of learning this syntax, learn a different syntax, sure, but be very specific. And I think that interface changing really opens up these world of possibilities. And I like your framing of both, you know, almost like a member in the room and sort of how the younger generation works. You know, I've talked about this before where, you know, my kids, when they're debating, you know, sports statistics and the things that kids debate, like they don't just sit there and argue with each other. They start asking the Google in the room constantly to like weigh in and like, you know, arbitrate in some ways. And I think it's really changing the dynamic of those conversations. It's pretty interesting. Like they're having a very data-centric conversation on something as silly as like, you know, who's the best three-point shooter.
But actually, it's a big deal for them, right? So they want some data. They want to back it up. It's like, I have proof, you know? It's not just opinion.
Yeah, and they're not having to figure out how to query. They're just asking. And so I think that's a really thoughtful way to think about it. And it really does sort of change that dynamic. And I love the way of thinking about the ability to use it as a translation layer. As an example, you know, we here at User Testing have been pulling together a bunch of companies, frankly, over the last year. And it's funny, the mundane things you have to sort of sort out. And one of them, as silly as it sounds, is our expense policy. And one of the things I did was I just went and asked one of these, you know, chat interfaces, you know, give me this kind of expense policy with this kind of theme for a company this size, and out spits this policy. And I'm like, that's a pretty good starting point back to your blank page thesis, versus, you know, trying to sit down and write this from scratch. And so it really does change that whole productivity equation. So if we sort of dig in on that for a second. So, you know, on one side of the coin, there's this amazing ability to adapt and adopt this new technology, change the way we work, generate all this content. It seems like a big productivity boom. The other side of every productivity boom, I think, in history is people worried about, well, what does that mean for me and whose productivity is getting better and whose productivity is sort of getting absorbed by this technology? So what would you say to, you know, product leaders, UX researchers, designers, folks who are afraid of the impact that this could have on their jobs? Or maybe the flip side, how do they leverage this in their work? So how do you sort of approach that impact?
Being in the technology world, I kind of necessarily am optimistic. And so, you know, on the one hand, I don't want to come across as like Pollyannish, because people's livelihoods will be disrupted like that. That is going to happen. And so as a result, you kind of have to like rush into the fire, if you will, and sort of become a firefighter as you're kind of like seeing, you know, fire being invented or given down from the gods like to us in a way. That is a reference to Prometheus. Yes. So given that, I kind of like, I guess from a product and product design perspective, the way that I think about this is that we've made many both like compromises and we've subjected. So the way in which software kind of is developed currently is based on the industrial model in many respects. There, to some degree, is personalization when it comes to content on a page, you know, words that are written, you know, for an individual, or ads, for example, you know, like I get ads, you know, I don't know, for coffee things and stuff like that. And for people who don't drink coffee, that's a wasted ad dollar if it's like shown to someone like that. So there's personalization that happens almost in the fringes. But when it comes to software itself, the degree that you can imagine software being much more personalized either to the person and their knowledge of the world, their exposure and experience. You know, we kind of, I think where I'm seeing this the most is in IDEs or integrated development environments for engineers. You know, essentially you can imagine that you have a relatively junior engineer writing some code and they've got a co-pilot kind of like, you know, calling things out to them or pointing things out or like, oh, you know, you could do this in this way or whatever. And I don't think we've quite found a similar analog when it comes to visual software or visual interfaces for normal people yet. You know, we have the concept of Clippy, you know, where there's a little sort of annoying, you know, thing standing there and sort of, you know, saying things to you, or you've got a chat bot or a chat box where you're typing questions and things like that. And so maybe you're getting some ideas, but I actually think that video game design is probably closest to where we're going to end up. I mean, especially just looking at younger people, where there's almost like progressive disclosure or progressive complexity based on the nature of familiarity with a job or a task. So from a product design perspective, you can think about all those moments where there's some kind of friction, and what generative AI or, you know, artificial intelligence can do is it sort of like steps in as like sandpaper, you know, kind of right ahead of the person to like sand off those rough edges that for, you know, an experienced person, they're looking for a very sharp, you know, scalpel, but for someone who's not quite, you know, at that level of, you know, surgeon, you know, maybe they just need sort of like a butter knife. And so how can you change and develop and deliver software that's a lot more forgiving to the person based on whatever their current situation is? And so that, again, is not really the way that we've designed software, I think, up until now. You can imagine, well, I don't want to get into the car example too much, but I'm just sort of trying to unpack this idea that there's industrial software that's sort of designed once, like rolled out, and then people have to like be trained on it, as opposed to, I guess, the major concept that I would impress upon people is to think about the conversation runtime as being a place where you can deliver access to services or capabilities in a way that's both kind of optimistic and eventually arrives at the outcome that you're seeking by having a bi-directional interaction. Those are a bunch of big words. But basically, like, humans have figured out how to talk to each other, how to use nonverbal cues, you know, sort of nodding and saying yes, and then adapting the language that we use to express a concept that's abstractly in our minds so that someone else can access that part of our brain that is saying something clear, like, oh, I want to go have lunch. And you're like, I know what lunch means. I know a place. And that instantly happens. But with software, you have to go through like several layers of translation to get to the outcome that you're actually seeking. And so from a product design and development perspective, I think that's where this conversational runtime allows for adaptive software that we've barely even seen, like, I guess, in the wild yet.
I relate to that. I think one of the things that we've been thinking through a lot in our product area is, in a lot of cases, we're in industry and sort of design and UX research that came up through a very high degree of specialization. Mm-hmm. Like, it is not uncommon to meet people who have a PhD in human-computer mm-hmm. interaction that have gone into this field. And I think what we're aspiring for is a way where that expertise can really be elevated to even bigger problems, because the skill set is able to be at a lower mm-hmm. level, you know, really hand it out to a wider audience who don't have to sort of climb that level of expertise. I think there was this strategy for a little while where it was like, well, let's just sort of lightly train everybody to do this yep. job who's going to use the software. And then you sort of are telling people that spent 8 years getting a PhD, we're going to run some people through a quick 30-minute mm-hmm. course, and they're going to do part of your job. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of insulting at face value, right? Versus, hey, there is a lot of expertise here. Some of that we might be able to systematize into a pretty smart mm-hmm. software model. Not all of it, and certainly not the higher value stuff, but quite a bit of it. And I think it sort of addresses the distribution of just maybe how much opportunity there is for that surface area to be used. And I think that's true in so many areas of software, which maybe we'll go to your fund, which I want to talk to in just a mm-hmm. second about your fund and kind of why you are focused in this area, which I think is very smart. Before we do that, I do want to hit on one other area, which I just think is very interesting for our audience. You are arguably the number one product hunter on Product Hunt.
Just by volume.
Which is a website where yes. yeah, new products are shared, discovered, upvoted. It's just a fascinating site. You have found and helped feature more than 3,800 products on that yes. site. So first off, if anybody's not familiar with Product Hunt, maybe give a quick background. And then could you share, based on all of that interaction, what do you think makes for a good product in today's digital world? Like, what do you see replicated as a successful model?
Yeah, you know, it's a really good, I guess, you know, pivot in the conversation in a way, because, you know, I've been on Product Hunt since 2014, and, you know, it is probably, you know, the way that I would analogize it, it's like the slowest form of social media, because you create a post kind of every 6 months when you drop a new version of your product. So it's like version one comes out and then you do a bunch of work. 6 months later, version two comes out and you have your second post. So it's like the slow, you know, I'm used to being on Twitter where it's, or well, RIP Twitter, but, you know, used to being on sort of microblogging platforms where the cadence of content being produced is at such a high clip that, you know, you're sort of like, you know, learning very quickly. And anyways, so Product Hunt is a much slower form.
Well, slow food became a cool trend. Yeah. Maybe slow social media could be too. I sort of like the idea at face value.
I mean, we sort of started there with blogging.
Sorry to interrupt your flow there, but yeah. I love it. It's great. I would sign up for slow social media.
You know, I think like the other reason why it's important or relevant, given the conversation that we're having about AI, is because of the way in which I've noticed products launching on Product Hunt have, you know, started to evolve and change as well. So let me back up a little bit and just explain again Product Hunt. So Product Hunt started out as a mailing list. The founder, Ryan Hoover, would sort of find cool things that his friends were launching, and would just send out stuff like, hey, you know, this is like way pre-Substack. This is like, you know, when email used to be just an actual decentralized product. And eventually he was like, you know, I should probably build a little website like this. And this is in the era of Dig, which is sort of like the, you know, predecessor to Reddit. And it was a platform for upvoting cool products that were being launched. It was a great place to find and discover new things. That was also, I think it preceded the App Store. In any case, place to find cool stuff. And over time, what would happen is he would create this leaderboard, and the leaderboard would refresh every night at midnight. So there'd be a new set of apps and people would just like rush to like upvote the top things. And then the game would reset every day. And so it's a really effective infinite game, you know, if you think about it from that perspective. And so I just, as both a product designer and as a tech enthusiast and as someone who just like loved to see cool things getting built, I got on early and I just kind of like followed it. And what's been so useful is that it's the closest thing to a kind of like to see the scientific method being played out, but in product design. Because every day now, especially, and this has been true for the last several years, there is anywhere from, you know, 40 to 60 to 80 new products that are launching on a daily basis, on a daily basis. So what you're doing is you're able to see what people are doing to solve problems, you know, with technology, how they articulate those solutions. So for every launch, there's, you know, a little icon, there's the name of the product, there's a tagline where you've got 60 characters to describe what the thing does. Then you go into the description, that's 260 characters. And you have like a maker comment where the person who's building the thing, and I think this is where it differs from like the App Store, gets to tell their story and journey for how and why they're building this thing. So you learn a lot just by seeing how people are thinking about problems and what problems are actually willing and able to tackle as new technology becomes more available. You know, so for example, you know, the Vision Pro has just launched, and in the last week, there's, you know, 10 to 15 apps for the Vision Pro that are now being featured on Product Hunt. And so it's a place to discover and find those things that otherwise, you know, you'd have to use social media, you know, and sort of pan for gold to hope that you might actually come up with something. But in this case, you're seeing like the people who are building this stuff there talking to you about their experience, and it's just very distilled. So to answer your question, I think a good launch on Product Hunt today really has a couple, key facets and aspects that I look for. You know, one is like, what is this thing and what is it trying to do? You know, there's a lot of people who end up being so close to a problem that they forget that they have to explain it to a bunch of people who have no idea what they're talking about. So that's the first thing. What is it? Who is it for? And I think the second thing is like, what is unique about this product right now? You know, there's a lot of stuff out there that has been tried many, many times. And sometimes like timing is the most important thing. And so when it comes to launching a Product Hunt, you've got to be taking advantage of something that's going on in the world. Now, I'll give you an example. Last year, as the economy was starting to, you know, sort of like shut down and there was a lot of fears and the year of efficiency and things like that. Of course, for startups, they needed to extend their runway. And so there were several startups or products that launched that would allow you to, let's say, optimize your Amazon Web Services bill. Or there was another one that would allow you to move off of Stripe and to charge people's debit cards directly so that you didn't have to worry about chargebacks and things like that. Those did really well on Product Hunt and ended up getting featured because they provided an economic answer to a question that founders had at the time, which was, how do I navigate this current moment in space? So it's also really interesting to see for teams that are organized around moving quickly and kind of riding the wave of whatever is happening to be able to launch and develop products that are almost you know, happening kind of real time as the, you know, environment is also evolving. So that's been very useful for me to see. And again, circling back to our earlier conversation, literally like today, and it's been true, I mean, for the last year, I would say anywhere from 30 to 60% of the products coming out have some generative AI aspect to them. Almost like anybody that launches some document collaboration tool has the ability to talk to a PDF or to generate images on the fly, or any of those things, again, have just become, you know, if you can like open a file or a photo from your desktop, you know, the ability to generate an image on the fly is now just kind of table stakes. I think it's been really interesting to just witness that and to see real stuff getting built.
Yeah, I think it's been fun. I've been playing around with a bunch of these emerging products and the power that they have. I mean, it's part of what I just find so incredible. Mm-hmm. I mean, your first reaction, you know, if you've been in the software space a long time like I have, is like, oh my gosh, they must have a massive team building this. And you realize like, no, this is the scale. So I think it's going to really change the dynamic for how fast really powerful, high quality stuff comes out. So
I think this is almost like what I'm saying, just because I think this point is really worth building on, right? Which is that not only is the software incredibly powerful, but it also allows for these bespoke solutions where an individual, again, you mentioned like the experts who've built up this expertise over time. The way in which I think product development is going to change is that the role of orchestrator or curator is going to become a lot more important. So having the ability to discern which set of solutions make sense in different contexts based on how you're deploying, you know, software or products, I think is going to be a really, really big thing, because you're going to be able to like almost build any kind of software that you want, type it into a chatbot, it produces a website for you, and it may look like crap, but you know, it's sort of like, well, it's good, right? Like it's a website, but the ability to know what's good and why it's good and how deep it needs to go, I think is like the next level of unlock, you know, for a lot of different companies and a lot of different businesses.
Yeah.
You know, where the degree to which a business understands itself and communicates itself and what it does to its own team, I think is going to be incredibly important, because then you deputize, you know, your employees to basically go use these tools to solve people's problems.
Well, I think that's a great point. I think it allows also a level of sophistication for solving what might be either relatively niche or previously considered low value problems. I use this analogy.
Or too expensive.
Yeah. So, I mean, I use this analogy all the time of Excel, which is sort of this amazing platform where the most sophisticated finance people in the world use Excel. We also—
There's a world series of Excel, like macros that I discovered.
We also use it to organize the snack list for my daughter's softball team, right? So like you can do both, right? It's sort of part of the amazing part of Excel. But if you start to think about like, take that really silly example of a snack list, that could start to be a pretty sophisticated piece of logistics. Like who's bringing what? Like we could start really doing and not having anybody have to spend a lot of time on it. And one developer one day could say, I'm going to fix the snack list problem. And all of a sudden you could really go deep. So I think it's fascinating. So if that's the surface area of the impact.
Well, let me build on that actually, just for a very specific example. I don't know if, you know, Excel tends to be sort of in the Microsoft land, but like, you know, if you happen to have an iOS device and you use Reminders, which I hadn't used for the longest time, you know, I use Things on the Mac or whatever. They have recently introduced this smart lists thing specifically for grocery lists. And so when you add an item, you know, let's say eggs, it'll ask if you want to move it to a specific section in the grocery store that you're more likely to find that thing in that aisle. This is a great example, like a super, you know, benign use case for generative AI or just AI in general. And, you know, I use it with my family, and like the kids are so much more productive when they go to the grocery store to like find stuff, you know, because of this sort of sorting thing. And so that would have been a feature years ago that would have made kind of no sense to build, because you're like, how do you index how do you index all items in the grocery store and put them into the proper sort of sorting mechanism or something? But now you have generative AI, and so it sort of just makes it very easy. You know, the kids will like write things like, you know, two potatoes that are red, and it still is able to identify that, as opposed to being like, anyway. So I think it's a really good example where the Excel thing as just a set of blocks that you can put content into then unlocks this whole different world and direction that you can go in if you are paying attention to how people are struggling to use the current generation tools.
Absolutely. And you do have to be a little careful when the kids get access to the grocery list. So my kid figured out that they heard my wife and I telling our Google Home about the shopping list. And then I have an amazing video of my kids when they were like, I don't know, 5 and 8 or something, and they were adding stuff to the grocery list. It was like s'mores.
Like 300 pounds of marshmallows.
Yeah, I was just like, okay.
Exactly. Always the marshmallows.
It was kind of amazing. So maybe you can democratize too far. I don't know. So let me. I do want to pivot to your AI fund because it maybe not investing in.
So I can say something about that. Treats.
But yeah, I'd love to hear a little bit about the fund. What are AI founders getting right and wrong, and sort of what are you focused on as you sort of think about bringing capital into that space?
Yeah. So the way that the fund came about, and again, you know, I've had a very interesting and sort of curious, you know, career in Silicon Valley. You know, I got started working on the launch of Firefox and was deeply involved with the early kind of web ecosystem and open source and technologies. But I was never an engineer, never a developer. I just kind of played one on the internet, I suppose. I was actually trained in communication design. And so I've been very fascinated by the way in which language has expanded, hence, you know, my relationship to the hashtag. During the pandemic, I was sheltered in place kind of by myself, and I was going for these walks, and I'd be listening to, you know, daily podcasts. And one of them was the Tech Meme Ride Home show, where the host is Brian McCullough. And he had previously interviewed me for his other other podcast, the Internet History podcast. And so he and I kind of went way back. And anyways, I was listening to his show, and every day I'd sort of listen to him say stuff, and I'd be like, I have opinions, like, what the heck? So I ended up inviting him on to Clubhouse, RIP. And we ended up having these kind of like weekly shows where I would kind of find my friends who are in the news stories and get them onto the show. And we'd have this conversation about what was going on in the world as it was ending. And so anyways, after the world did not end and we came back, you know, I was kind of thinking about what I wanted to do next. And even though Brian and I were continuing to do the podcast thing, I was like, look, you know, Brian, like I discovered this ChatGPT thing and I posted it to Product Hunt in November of 2022, and it quickly became Product of the Year on Product Hunt. And I was like, you know, I had previously tried to build a conversational AI company in 2017, and it was just too brittle and too hard. And like we talked about, natural language was not natural. This, on the other hand, this is what we were missing, and this is going to unleash a huge wave of possible things. And so, given, you know, what I do on Product Hunt already, and given what Brian does on the Tech Meme show, we have great access to founders who are building for this new opportunity. Why don't we bring some capital to the space? You know, Brian already gets people on the show. I help people launch. Seems like a great kind of combo together. And, you know, as I was kind of explaining to Brian what I thought was going to happen, you know, being a California boy now, it sort of occurred to me that what's going to happen in the AI space kind of is what I call kind of AI varietals. And so if you drink wine at all, or if you know anything about grapes, which I didn't before either, it turns out that there's both a lot of different varietals, i.e. varieties, and that the soil in which they grow and the environment and the, you know, weather in which they grow has a great deal to do with an influence on the quality of the product that comes out the other end. So my thought was that data is not like the new oil, although of course having a lot of it is useful. Data is sort of like the new terroir, to sound even more douchey. But basically kind of like, you know, it's like the soil. It's like the dirt, and you need a lot of dirt, and the dirt is going to determine the types of products and applications you can build. And so the AI wrangler is kind of like the winemaker in this metaphor, who comes in and sort of understands how to orchestrate all these different things together, and then produces a product for a certain type of, you know, place, you know, like Napa or Sonoma or Santa Rosa, or, you know, whatever, or France, Italy, you know, places around the world. So the idea essentially is that the fund is investing in founders who have some domain expertise in some place. Usually kind of that means that they understand the language, the vernacular, the problems that a vertical is experiencing, and they team up with some sort of, you know, ML or AI engineer who can bring generative AI or AI solutions into that space. So it's the pairing of the two. It's the knowledge and expertise that then can be used to actually, you know, build real solutions.
It's a fascinating thesis. I'm looking forward to following it as it plays out. I definitely think it's a great way to think about the expansive opportunity, but the focus that some of this is going to require to sort of really drive success, and sort of relates back to the analogies we were using earlier. So super interesting. So again, really, it was a pleasure to have you on just to get to talk about this stuff. I really, really enjoyed it. If folks are interested in following you, is Product Hunt the best place? Twitter, where should folks stay connected to you?
I also had a funeral for myself on Twitter. So I moved over to Threads. I'm very easy to find on Threads. I'm just threads.net/@Chris. I was the 19th user of a product called Bourbon, and then Bourbon became Instagram. And so I've sort of just, you know,
not bad.
Been on the platform ever
since.
That's
a good handle.
It is, and then it's not, given the number of people who want it. You know, Chris Hemsworth and those guys. But whatever, I'm there. It's mine. I was there first.
There you go.
So I have it.
I like it. All right. So that's,
anyway, so that's a good place.
Spot.
And then Product Hunt's good.
Product Hunt's good.
And then chrismessina.me is my website. Yep.
Awesome. All right. Well, again, this was super enlightening. Really, really enjoyed it. Thanks for coming on and sharing some of your thoughts. And look forward to following you on those platforms.
Yeah. Well, awesome. Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me.
Want to keep the conversation going? You can find the show notes at usertesting.com/podcast. If you haven't already, don't forget to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Overcast, or Google Play so you never miss an episode. And if you enjoyed today's show, please share it with a friend or leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. And until next time, this is Insights Unlocked, an original podcast from User Testing.